Pentagon has announced the suspension of military cooperation with Russia because of the ongoing presence of Russian forces in the Crimean region of Ukraine. This ongoing standoff has spooked world markets. The economic effect has been huge, particularly on the issue of energy security, gas and oil prices rising over fears that a conflict could have a bad impact on the supply of resources. And meanwhile, the US says that it's got a range of economic levers it can pull in order to try to halt the advance of Russian forces. How much will diplomatic and economic measures really make a difference here? Can you actually do anything just by pulling those levers? I'm joined now by Natalie Doyle, who's Deputy Director of the European and EU Centre at Monash University. Natalie, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, Waleed.
Pretty terrifying situation in the Crimea region of Ukraine, I would have thought anyway, and the US President looking to placate this with economic rather than military measures. Do you think that that's realistic?
Well, I think it, up to a point it's realistic. It's realistic in the sense that certainly for the Europeans, a very, you know, shaky economic recovery in some countries and in other countries not at all, disruption to the gas supply would not be a good thing. But for the Russians also, you know, the Russians need to sell the gas, they need the money. So I think they both in it together, and so that's one way of moving the situation.
Right, but is it possible Russia can find other nations to sell the gas to?
Well, certainly, but the Europeans also don't just buy the gas from Russia. They buy it from Algeria as well and Norway. And, of course, you know, the EU is not a single entity, so different countries are more exposed than others.
You think the US has responded quickly enough to this, and particularly by reaching for the economic dimension of this?
Are they reacting quickly enough?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they are. But I think, you know, the economic measures are not the only ones. I mean, they are also... there's also the, you know, the old-fashioned approach, which is diplomacy. I think, you know, there's still room for diplomacy, precisely because I don't think that it is really in the interest of the Russians either to have a full military confrontation over Ukraine. So room for diplomacy, definitely, and also financial sanctions.
Well, what do you think Russia would have to gain, though, from a military invasion, particularly if the West is not going to get involved militarily and not going to try to stop it? Is it possible that they might weigh up the pros and cons and come up in favour of going in?
Oh, that's definitely a possibility, especially we don't know how it actually plays out for the domestic audience. You know, to what extent is this really something that Putin is using for, you know, to regain more popularity support within Russia when there are economic difficulties, you know, when there are all those issues, obviously, over lack of transparency, lack of rights? I think we don't know.
Right, and he's very interested in this Eurasian concept of expanding Russia to its former glory. He's trying to cobble together alliances of other regimes or other countries in the region, most of which are authoritarian. I mean, this is a pattern that you could easily look at and say, well, he could be prepared to go quite a long way to realising this.
You can, but I think you don't want to fall into interpretation of Russians' behaviour that's very much coloured, you know, about what we remember from the Cold War. I mean, we also have to look at you know, the good old security dilemma. To what extent was the behavior of Europe, the European Union, and the West more generally, that means obviously the US, in terms of the expansion of NATO, and the fact that they never really resolved, you know, this question of was the EU the same thing as NATO? No, it's not. But the two were linked. And this was considered to be defensive, obviously, by countries that had been occupied by Russia, Poland, most notably. But obviously what they perceived as a defensive measure, the Russians interpreted as an offensive measure. And plus also this question of them, you know, through their history, having considered that as their sphere of influence. So all those things, you know, are part of the mix. And it's really hard to distinguish, you know, what kind of a role, obviously, to what extent the Russians have initiated this. And there was a kind of rivalry also over the trade agreements, the ones that, you know, the trade agreement that was offered by the EU, which was then through the so-called Eastern Partnership, which then, you know, the Russians then countered with the invention of rival cultural trade entity.
Yeah. Well, was this perhaps the EU, or maybe we should be more precise and say NATO's biggest blunder here, or biggest provocation, I suppose, was the expansion of NATO and really moving NATO right up to Russia's border, which has led to the situation down the track that we find now?
I think it's played a role. I wouldn't say that it is the only reason, because you don't want to say that Putin is a lovely benign leader, and you don't want to consider that he's a victim in the matter. I mean, he does have still dreams of imperialistic grandeur. There's no denying it. But obviously, there was an opportunity in the past, and that's before Putin, to negotiate a security map of Europe that would not have been based on the old lines of the Cold War.
Just thinking about the energy aspects of this, can you give us a sense of just how much is at stake here and how strategically important Ukraine is?
Well, Ukraine is important because a lot of the pipelines that carry the gas out of different gas-producing areas of Russia reach Europe, and there was a big crisis in 2009, which led to an interruption of the supply. So yes, it's important. But as I said, when we first started talking about the situation, the member states of the European Union and obviously other European countries and member states, learned the lessons from the crisis of 2009 and started working on becoming more energy independent of Russia through different measures. So sourcing different sources, as I said, for example, Algeria, and also creating a different pipeline route, which comes through the north rather than going through Ukraine.
And how much do you think the fact that Ukraine itself seems to be divided between European and Russian leanings is contributing to the situation? Is an issue of borders perhaps being in the wrong place or some other way in which this country could have been divided?
Well, are you going to have me jumping up and down, Wally? Because I really think that is what is wrong in what is being written today in the West about Ukraine. There's this use of sort of Huntingtonian references to kind of civilization clash running through Ukraine. That is not true. That is not true. I mean, there are, and people often think that because they have a kind of simplistic understanding of Ukraine. It's linguistically incredibly complex, meaning there are Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians and there are Russian-speaking Ukrainians as well as ethnic Russians.
Right.
And that's a separate issue. But lots of Russian-speaking Ukrainians, in fact, respect the fact that Ukraine as an independent state is, to a certain extent, represented by the Ukrainian language. So it's much more complex than this divide.
Complexity, Natalie. We're on radio. We don't do complexity here.
I know that, Wally, but I'm an academic.
Fair enough. And just before I let you go, I know you've been watching social media on this. Have you seen anything interesting or anything instructive?
Well, I mean, I've been following the Facebook sites that have come up in support of the protest movement that started in Kiev, the so-called Euromaidan movement, which was, the Maidan squares where the protesters gathered. Mm. And of course, it was triggered initially by the president's change of heart, not to sign the agreement with the EU and to go over to the Russians. And so that's why the movement became, acquired the nickname Euromaidan, which I suppose encouraged the view that it was all to do with Ukraine joining the EU, and I think that's not the main issue. But anyway, so there are Facebook sites, and that's when you sort of go on those Facebook sites and you see what different Ukrainians write, as well as Ukrainians who live outside Ukraine now, you get a sense that it's not nearly like what we read about in the press.
Natalie Doyle, we do have to leave it there, but thank you very much for your insights. I've got a feeling we're going to learn a lot more about this over the coming weeks and months.
Yes, I'm sure. Well, it's quite worrying, actually.
Oh, yeah. Well, your worrying is does not make you alone, that's for sure. Natalie Doyle, Deputy Director of the European and EU Centre at Monash University. It's 16 minutes past 7. We'll leave Ali with you for Drive.